Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Alan Parker said, "Sometimes, with the British film industry, it's hard to know if we're waving or drowning. Let's find out."
Hi, just interrupting the start of this podcast to let you know that I've split the interview I did with Simon Rumley about his 2010 film Red, White and Blue into two separate podcasts. So, you're now listening to one of two. Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today we've got a special Halloween show, and I've got Simon Rumley in the house.
Hello.
Quite literally.
In the house. Yeah. In the living room.
In the living room of my house. I'm loving this novelty of having people in the room while I talk to them, as opposed to this discombobulated voice that comes over Skype and we talk and I look at my laptop screen. It's quite nice. But we've not come to talk about my existential crisis of talking to people. We've come to talk about your 2000 and... What year would you say?
Well, I shot it in 2009, and then I guess it came out 2010, 2011.
So was it 2011 Fright Fest I'd seen it?
No, that would have been 2010, because we premiered in Rotterdam and South by Southwest, so in 2010. So that, it was very much, you know, on the circuit in 2010, so Fright Fest would have...
So you're from Red, White and Blue, I should say. So before we go into any detail about it, and talk about creating that film, and I should add, there will be spoilers, we're not going to apologise for that. This is about looking back on a favourite film of mine. Do you want to give us a brief synopsis as you see Red, White and Blue?
Well, I guess I've always described it as a story about three people who meet and come to a crossroads in their lives, and how their interaction with each other affects them forever. Mm. I know when we first tried doing that kind of the synopsis of the film, it was actually quite hard. So that was our kind of deliberately slightly obscure, I suppose, explanation. And of course, it's set in Austin, Texas, which plays into the title to an extent, and gives the film its atmosphere. But yeah, it's about three people, three good people doing bad things, but almost by mistake, really.
And people listening will notice that you're not from Austin, Texas.
That's right.
But watching the film, it feels like a very real, awful slice of life in Texas. So where do you start with a story you're going to set in Texas as a writer first?
Well, I'm from Tunbridge Wells, rural Tunbridge Wells originally, so quite a far cry from Texas and indeed Austin. I'd been to Texas. I'd been to Austin before with my film The Living and the Dead in 2006. Mm-hmm. I think I'd been to it once before for a few days, but I spent a week there, and it's quite different from how it is now. And it really was that kind of Americana that I grew up kind of thinking about and watching in Wim Wenders films and, you know, rock and roll films and rock and roll music and all that kind of stuff. And with a bit of cowboy thrown in and Mexican food and all that kind of stuff. And there was something, and neon lights everywhere. And it was very romantic and a kind of very romantic view of Americana. So, you know, I think the story could have taken place, frankly, in Blackpool. You know, the story itself could have taken place anywhere. It's just that I so happened to set it in Austin. And actually, as the first draft was pretty much the first section and the second section pretty much as per the film. But the third section, the ending changed, and the whole Nate and Noah Taylor's character became in the second or third draft became what you see in the film. And it was only through struggling to find a title and having given it to a few people who liked up until the ending, that the whole Nate thing came along and the whole thing about him being in the CIA and getting an honorable discharge and all that kind of stuff, and then coming up with the title for the film, which I felt worked on many different levels. But yeah, so you know, it's a story that in reality could happen anywhere, and I was always interested in those things that were those literally paragraph kind of box like stories in tabloids, which I don't know if you've seen them, but you know, which would explain how some man killed his lover of 10 years and all that kind of stuff, and you just think, you know, I suppose, you know, they're crimes of passion, much like Red, White, and Blue, and you just think, you know, how do people end up doing that kind of thing, and whether it's in Ipswich or indeed Austin, and it's, you know, it's still all about human psychology and stuff. So I started it from a humane point of view, thinking the characters, although they're very specific, and the way we kind of fleshed out, for example, Mark Center's character in the rock band, you know, that felt like a very Austin kind of thing, which if it had been set in Blackpool would have been, you know, a different kind of band. You know, maybe it would be a more indie like kind of rock band or something. So you know, a lot of it came with, of course, the production design and costume. And
before I go into more detail about that, I guess I should just rewind a second and say what for me was exciting about seeing your film, and I saw it when it played at Fright Fest, and I think this is a constant in all the films that I've enjoyed of yours, is that you set us up with a situation, you give us people, but you don't just feed us with what we want. We as an audience have to work, and in a horror situation, and I was saying before we started recording that I was trying to sum up what Red, White and Blue was, and I was saying that it was a harrowing tragedy because there's no villains in it, but people end up doing villainous things. And all the while, you know, as the tick in the bad box keeps growing more and more, whereas it starts off with this kind of innocent mystery that grows into a whole heap of stuff that means that it can only go one way, but down the pan.
Yeah.
For everybody,
yeah.
I never knew where you were going. I felt uncomfortable for most of the film, and even when it resolved, it wasn't like a hopeful end.
No,
it was a bleak end, to say the least. But because it has such a sort of climax of violence, whereas I guess the first three quarters of it is what a friend of mine has described when he was talking about Locke as being emotional violence. You really do give us universal truths, subvert them, and then make us feel bloody awful about it. And also, I think obviously everybody's a book cover that we judge, and film is a great one for that, because you can go, here's someone doing something. So obviously, here's Erica. She's fucking everything that moves. I don't approve of that kind of thing. And then we find out more and more about her. We learn more about who she is. And we begin to soften that judgment of her. The opposite, I guess you would say, with, say, Frankie, is you go, look at him, he's in a punk rock band, look at him wasting his life. And then you go, here he is looking after his cancer dying mother. Oh, he's got a heart. And then, so you really are playing with real simple ideas, but it's really effective because we as the audience are completely tricked by the first thing and then either disappointed or relieved, as it were, in terms of where it takes us. And the same with Nate. So we've got three characters, and you're kind of your Red, White and Blue, and it's almost like the film is three chapters where you kind of introduce them all and then concentrate on one and end on a finale. So whose film did you think it was when you started writing it? Or
again, kind of, you know, it kind of was everyone's, you know, I suppose the film really came from my, irrational or not so irrational fear of one night stands and, you know, would I catch AIDS from a one night stand? That was where the germ of the idea came from. And how disturbing would it be, you know, to find, you know, for all the people who've been diagnosed with AIDS, you know, how do they react to it? How do they respond to it? And how do they cope with it? And rather than take, I suppose, the positives of how people cope, I thought it'd be interesting to put it in more of a kind of horror context. And shit, my life is destroyed, and how does that make me feel? But I think it always started with Erica, and when I wrote it, I roughly knew where I was going, but again, it was Erica's story really that I wanted to set her up as the main protagonist really. But as you say, it's everything about it is kind of almost triptych or tripartite, in as much, which is why we in the end, why I went for red, white, and blue, because it's three words and there are three characters, and most films are three acts, but this is very clearly delineated into three acts, more so than in most films, even though the three act structure is quite different from your traditional three act structure. So it is about every character, and as you say, I wanted to show that they're all, I wanted to subvert a few things. In a way, it was a slasher film, and that was, going back to The Living and the Dead. When I did that, I went around the world and people saying, is it a horror film? We're not sure if it's really a horror film. And I was going, well, it is and it isn't. And so I like the idea of continuing that and taking what is probably the most obvious kind of horror medium, which is the slasher film, and taking that and really subverting it and saying, well, it's not a guy running through a field with a knife trying to kill a naked girl. It's actually a naked girl, trying to kill some guys with, and not with a knife, but with her body. And how kind of mind fucking is that? Because in theory, what should be an enjoyable experience, for most or for all concerned, suddenly turns into this nightmare. So it was taking, quite a few things and playing with them really.
Yeah. So for such a assured character as she is at the point when we meet her in the film, we're not saying a lot about men, are we?
We are not saying a lot about men
at all. Oh, sorry, we are saying a lot about men, but it's not. We're not that men. Men aren't a very complex being when it comes to someone saying or offering you sex on a plate.
No, and again, that's, I guess, as a male, you were saying, yeah, wouldn't it be amazing? And someone came up and said, hey, yeah, let's go back to your room, and then you realise that actually, the people who generally do that, it doesn't happen every day, and there's probably a reason that it doesn't happen every day.
It happens in porn films.
It happens in porn films, but apart from that, yeah, which I haven't seen any of those recently, but I've heard about them. And I think. It doesn't, and I suppose also, she is a predator, and so she understands her target, and she, she wouldn't necessarily target people who she thought she couldn't, sleep with. So she does go to those, she does go to bars and just waits to be approached.
Mm.
And if you put a girl in a bar, a single girl in a bar who's, even if she's, well, let's say a pretty girl in a bar by herself, at some point a guy will start talking to her, and or a few guys will start talking to her, and the reality is most of the guys who start talking to her, that they're not going to be talking to her because they're interested in her view on politics.
Yeah, or worried if she's lonely.
Or if she's lonely, or and her emotional well-being. They see an opportunity which they're going to take advantage of. And little knowing, of course, that she's set the trap herself.
Mm.
So for all the men in the film that do take advantage of her, they're ultimately the ones who are being taken advantage of. But I think there's many men, of course, who wouldn't have approached her and who indeed didn't approach her. But we obviously just focus on the ones who do.
And for a role like Erica, and up until that point, sort of Amanda Fuller had had some sort of mainstream TV roles and stuff that she would have been known for.
Mm.
So to go from kind of more wholesome TV roles to this, I mean, it's like Femme Fatale with Turned Up to 11, isn't it?
In a sense. Yeah.
What's your conversation like in casting there as the director with her?
Well,
because there's no way to dress this up, is there?
No, not at all. Well, casting that film was very strange because Noah Taylor was our first choice, and And I thought it was unrealistic. But then we found out that he lived in actually Brighton. And so we approached his agent literally about 3 days before I was due to go out to Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And said, hey, is Noah available? Can he read this? If he likes it, can he meet up with Simon before he goes to Austin in 3 days? So the agent was like, yep. So we're like, okay, great. And so that's exactly what happened. You know, met him. He loved the script. He wanted to meet me, of course. I think he watched The Living and the Dead. He wanted to make sure that it wasn't just about the violence, which of course it wasn't.
Mm.
And then he came back and said, yeah, you know, this is actually kind of what I've been wanting to do my whole life, pretty much. So we were just very lucky that it was, because he often plays slightly more quirky characters, sometimes quite geeky characters, and he's actually, you know, he's a really very interesting guy, and you know, he has quite a dark side, and he wanted to do something dark. He wanted to play a killer, basically.
Yeah.
I'd always you know, loved his work. You know, ever since his first film, The Year My Voice Broke, I'd always watch his films if I could. So I guess I always sensed there was something there which wasn't always on the screen, which as it turns out, I was right. So casting him was amazing, but actually, as these things go, about as easy as it gets. Because, you know, agents usually try to block these things, and you know, and then actors take, you know, 2 months to read and then whatever. But this was like, yes, and credit to his agent as well for actually making that, you know, credit to Noah and the agent. So for Erica, it was a lot harder. I think we actually spoke to three actresses at the time one's actually very well known now. One's like pretty much an A-lister. Well, actually, yeah. One has fallen off the scene completely, and one is, I don't know what she's doing. But they all really liked, and they're all, you know, through personal connections, they all liked the script, but, you know, the A-lister now didn't want to do it because she'd literally done her first film opposite a Hollywood lead. Hmm. And then the two other girls, one had done violence before, the other had done sex before, and he, both were kind of nervous of doing both either of those things again, let alone the sex and the violence together. So they in the end kind of both dropped out. And then we tried casting it in Austin, and again, that just wasn't happening. We had an amazing casting director called Karen Holford, and she's like, yeah, I think this is going to be tough to cast because, you know, there is quite a puritanical element to Austin people still. And she said, you know, in reality, I don't know if we've got good enough actresses to do this, but let's try. So we tried, but that wasn't working. And we were literally like, I think 5 days before principal photography, and still didn't have an actress. And so my manager, who he wasn't my manager at the time, but he was like, so what are you going to do if you can't cast this role? And I said, well, we will. He said, but what if you don't? I said, well, we will. He said, okay, let me put it another way. You haven't got an actress and you're 5 days away from filming and her on the first day. What are you going to do? And I was like, well, I don't know. I think we're just carrying on casting. And he said, okay, look, I've got an idea. Why don't we get an LA casting person on board? She can do an open casting assignment. Or call, I should say. And let's see what happens. So I was like, yep, sounds a great idea. So that's what we did. And literally, that happened like the next day. And I think, I think that 40 people kind of said they were interested. I think kind of 20 people read the script and said they weren't interested. Then another 20 or so did self-taping sessions. And I think from those self-taping sessions, I think there was literally Amanda and one other girl who I thought were really good.
Mm-hmm.
Or were good. And then, so I flew to LA literally the next day and saw five girls. And so...
Just out of interest then, so at that point where your manager Sabir said, get a casting director in LA to do a shout out.
Yeah.
So from, and that day you're 5 days in counting.
Yeah.
So when you get the, we've got Amanda and this other person, and you fly to LA, how many days have passed now?
Literally Amanda came, I think pretty much on the day we started shooting. And I think we may have swapped, you know, a bit of schedule around. But, I mean, it literally happened pretty much, you know, night, you know, day after day after day. And so...
Can I ask you then, just from a kind of filmmaker point of view, how do you prepare to make the film when, like, your manager's obviously implying you've got this... You've got one leg of a three-legged stool missing.
Well, it is a good question. I think, you know, something very similar happened on The Living and the Dead, where it was impossible. Again, casting the lead character, we end up using Leo Bill, and he was the only person we ever saw, literally. We saw him a couple of years before the film actually happened, after he'd come out of RADA, because our casting director recommended him. I saw him, liked him, had his quirkiness, met up with him. He was great. And then, 2 years later, and he loved it. 2 years later, went back to him. He was still up for it. Again, Roger Lloyd Pack, I think, was, you know, we spoke to a few people, but in the end, he was the one who really responded to it due to some of his own personal circumstances. But with the character, the mum, which in the end, Kate Farhi played amazingly, it was a struggle to get anyone to play that role. And we went through a lot of people. And again, it was literally, you know, a few days before we started shooting. And again, we were just slightly despairing, really. And Kate literally came in and saved the day. So I was kind of used to it. And I think, you know, knowing that these scripts were tough scripts, I felt... And, you know, it happened with Bitch, which was my... Short and Little Deaths, kind of after I did Red, White, Blue. You know, no one, we cast, we made offers. People even were coming in saying, you know, and actually auditioning, but then turning the part down once they'd auditioned, which was just bizarre. So you know, people, you know, wanted to do these edgy things, but actually in the end, most people didn't. So I'm a firm believer that in the end, that the person who wanted to do this script was out there, but we just had to find them. And that when we did find them, they would be perfect for the role. You know, looking back and actually talking now, maybe I was being a bit kind of innocent, naive, or stupid. But, you know, thankfully that's what we did.
I guess the benefit of that is you don't, with the role being such a tough role to play, as Eric is. You don't have that lengthy period of prep time of there being some negotiation about what it is and what you're not going to do.
No.
As a performer in that role, and equally, you don't have to be as thinking too hard.
Well, you know, and it was all very much in the script, so it wasn't like we're pulling in any surprises. But so in the end, you know, so went to LA, auditioned these five girls. The first three, again, were really just not quite right. And then there was, you know, the girl who I thought might have been quite good in the end. She was great, but she just wasn't really right. She didn't have the concentration and the intensity. And then Amanda came in, and I still roughly remember it, you know, and she was like, you know, I read the script, and a lot of the girls just didn't have very good questions, and Amanda had, like, you know, 20 minutes of questions, and she wanted to know if Milton Cam was the DP on it because she loved his work. And I was like, how does she know Milton Cam's work? But she'd watched The Living of the Dead, and she just everything about her, you know, she had that kind of frailty, but that beauty, that inner strength, kind of everything that was really required, and fearlessness as well. And you know, because there obviously are sex scenes, and it's like, well, so just to make sure, you know, there are sex scenes, we are looking for, you know, full nudity. You know, we'll obviously have another woman on set, and we'll have a closed set and all that kind of stuff, but it does require nudity.
But for the role itself as well, you know, the extreme moments aside, much of her performance is almost inward.
Well, it is.
There's no histrionics from her character at all because of who she is before the film starts and what she goes through the film. So in a way, once she's in front of camera, it's almost about getting her not to do stuff, I imagine. In terms of acting, it's like to pull the role off is like less is more every time with her, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, she, you know, she's an amazing actress, and you know, I still maintain, and having worked with her on Fashionista as well, of course, you know, I still maintain she's probably one of the best actresses of her generation, and you know, people can't train to act like that, and a lot of, you know, the Hollywood leads, you know, don't have to act like that, can't act like that, but she's just, you know, everything about her as well as a person actually is amazing, but as an actress, she's, yeah, you know, she can do still, she can do angry, she can do emotional, she can do violent, she can do vulnerable, she can do everything really. Certainly from my experience, and she can turn it on and off just like that. And you know, in the audition, I could, there was that stillness and that, again, that inner quality that you just have or you don't have.
One of my favourite moments is where there's like a where you do like a two part to your setup and payoff, where Erica basically says, "Why the hell would I want to talk to Nate?"
Yep.
And then as she's growing as a person within the context of the film, she comes to talk to Nate, and Nate just throws it right back at her.
Yeah.
But from his point of view, where he almost says word for word what she said to him.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's mortified. And it's a really interesting moment, because up until that point, I don't think we've seen emotion from her at all.
Yeah.
But because clearly her character has decided he's a good man, I can be friends with him.
Yeah. well, yeah, and very much... you know, the whole point of her character is that she lives a very lonely life. You know, she gets in this boarding house. She doesn't want to get close to people because she's already been damaged. You know, and she's, you know, in some respects, you know, she's the biggest nutcase you never want to meet, because she's decided that because she's been damaged, you know, all men are bad, and because all men are bad, she wants to, you know, harm all men, which obviously, you know, isn't great for anyone, most of all her. And so she's very deliberately trying to be, you know, alone and away from people, which is in the film, you know, you see her very much, you know, not interacting with other people, you know, on a kind of an emotional level or even a friendly level, you know. And the weird thing is, you know, the two people she makes friends with, one is little Alan, who's the you know, the kid in the playground, because she, you know, she doesn't feel threatened by him, but she can, you know, pour her love out on him without thinking that he will harm her in any way. And the other, of course, is Nate, who in the end intrigues her. And again, I think she senses something in him that he senses in her, and that they're both these kind of damaged goods, but there's something about them that just kind of work, you know, that she in the end feels works. And of course, at some point he actually protects her as well.
Now we'll get on to Nate in a second, but first I want to talk about Frankie.
Yeah.
Because what you're subverting already with the way that we go into a film is you've given us this ice cold sort of woman on a mission, and then you give us this male character who is like an emotional firework.
Yeah.
In comparison, he's open, he's optimistic.
Yeah.
He's really just full of, he's obviously just full of love as far as we get from him, and then you show that even more so with the scenes between him and his mother.
Yeah.
Where was that? Where's that coming from? Because that's not a typical male role anyway. Mm. It's certainly not a typical role for a man in a band.
Even. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, he's like he's almost like the epitome of naivety in a sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
and you're half cruel to him.
Yeah. No. Very much so. Well, again, you know, he. I suppose Shakespeare would say, you know, he's hoisted by his own petard. You know, he is his own worst enemy. But does he deserve what he gets? Probably not. Well, definitely not. But I think I wanted to make a character who, you know, who ultimately we can see is a good person, and I think. You know, him looking after his mother in spite of all the kind of fieriness and the masculinity and the drunkenness, you know, essentially like any kind of relatively, you know, red-blooded, you know, hot-blooded red, you know, male of that age, you know, he's into, you know, drink, drugs, rock and roll. I mean, obviously not women like that, but a lot are, and so I wanted him to be more than just that, and it seemed that, you know, loving your mother is, again, most men tend to not always love their mother, and I guess The Living Dead was about me spending time with my mum who was dying of cancer, so I was very aware that I was writing another film with a woman, a middle-aged woman with cancer and her son looking after her, but You know, and I thought, do I really want to go through that again? And in the end, I just thought, you know what? You know, it works in the context of the film, and it's not about me and stuff. So it was, you know, it was very much shorthand for, and it could have been his dad, but it always feels, you know, mother and son is obviously a different relationship from mother and father, and his father is in the film, and he has a kind of relationship with his father, but it's a little less, well, it's certainly less, you know.
I love that dynamic between the three of them.
Yeah,
Like, mum's just dying, and she's kind of, like, everything's relative.
Yeah, yeah.
And he obviously, he's now gone, I've been protecting mum since you fucked off.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And now you're back to try and give her your sympathy. Hold on a minute.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This isn't your space anymore. And it's lovely.
And the dad's got a new girlfriend, and you know all that kind of stuff. Who tries to be understanding, but that was really, you know, I suppose from a writing point of view, it's probably quite a cynical device to say, hey, you know, even though this guy is in a rock band and he gets drunk and he does fuck around and he's a bit hot headed and he fucks around with his employer, at heart he's, in spite of all this, you know, he's a good person, you know, and is a positive person, and so hopefully the audience, you know, sympathizes with him, really, because you know if any person seeing someone loving their mum and looking after his mum has got to be, you know, good at least in some respect. So that's, you know, that really was the device or tool.
And it's tonally, no matter what film you're watching, even just in the auspices of just your film, but any, the idea to go from this lone shark of Erica just going through life without any feeling, the contrast of then flipping that and giving us someone who's got a real purpose in life.
Yeah,
he's got a band to succeed in, he's got a mother to save,
yeah,
and he's got good friends around him, and he's, you know, everything's all right. And it really, you really feel that shift in tone, and you kind of go, oh, bright light, I wonder how that fits in with Erica.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you, as the nasty writer, don't just hit it. I mean, Frankie is the epitome of that theory, isn't it? Where get your hero up a tree,
yeah,
throw stones at him till he falls down.
Yeah,
you really do destroy Frankie.
Well, it's you know, it is a slow burn film, and as a writer, it was an interesting task to, you know, do it structurally in those three very separate episodes, but also keep the momentum. From when, because I think from when Frankie, you know, is at the doctor's for the first time, and he realizes what's happened, it's pretty much downhill, you know, there onwards. So although it is a slow burn, and you know, arguably it takes, I don't know, 40, 45 minutes, maybe 50 minutes to get to that point, the following 55 minutes are relentless in the, like, it's not going to get worse. Oh shit. Oh fuck. Oh, I can't get, oh my God. Oh fuck. And it's, you know, and to the point that, as you know, it's like everyone dies at the end, basically.
Because you give us the last glimmer of Frankie's hope is obviously the great news. They're about to get the support slot around Europe.
Yeah.
Quickly followed by you've got HIV.
Yeah.
Quickly followed by you've given your mum HIV.
Yeah.
And so that's Frankie's character, and it's kind of, he gets everything he doesn't deserve, but at the same time, he's his own worst enemy, which is kind of a beautiful and horrible irony. So Nate, Noah's character, is an antagonist in the sense of how the film ends, I suppose you could say, but he's equally an anti-hero in terms of the way the film ends at the same time, because while he's the Frankie and his friend's killer, he's doing it in Erica's memory, and things he does before is in his love towards whatever love he has for Erica and her life. So he's motivated by good.
Yes.
But what's interesting about his character for me, and I don't think the previous times I've watched it up until the one getting ready for this, is I hadn't really, I've seen this one about five times, and I've before this week, and I've missed this point, because I guess when you're not writing and you're not writing it, you're just watching. When he says dishonourable discharge from the army, and when he goes on to give his litany of I used to skin cats and set fire to parrots and stuff, which is always the best way to introduce yourself to a woman, I find, is to tell me how many pets you've tortured, and to which obviously Eric is just like, that's not good radio. That I just whacked my hand across my face.
Yeah.
She's got a blank stare on her face, which is to say, well, wait till I tell you my story.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
can see
yeah,
going on yeah, errand, you know. Yeah, might, yeah. You might have put your sister's pets up. My yeah, fucking stepdad did me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So in a sense, both of them, without saying it, create a mutual respect.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think he's probably the epitome, but you do it with all of them, is that in your writing, certainly in this film, and obviously it's evident in others, is that everybody says stuff, but none of us are telling us anything. We, the audience, are having to work this out. How do you get that? How do you make sure in your rewriting you get that balance right between us understanding enough to keep going and feel the momentum, but equally not just tell us, I'm a bad man. Oh, I'm a good man. Me.
Yeah.
That kind of shit.
Well, I guess it's called elliptical, I think. And it's, you know, it's... And that, you know, it is a very elliptical script, both in terms of, you know, progression from scene to scene and also from you know, from act to act. And part of it is, you know, I guess the secret is with ellipsis is actually leaving stuff out, and it's what you choose to leave out rather than what you choose to put in.
Hmm.
And it's, you know, when I wrote Fashionista, that was a very interesting process because I literally wrote everything as it appeared in the film, out of order. So, and there was a certain liberation in writing it out of order because I felt that I could really leave the very much, you know, the telling of the important facts at the very end. So it come. So again, it's withholding information. It's yeah, not telling stuff, and it's withholding information.
Mm.
And so, you know, with the red, white, and blue, the very last shot of the film is the a picture of Nate and Erica in their wedding outfit, and so we never see that they've been married. You know, we never see a marriage or a wedding. But you get the impression that, you know, if you put it all together, he's in bed with her and says, you know, I've got something really important I want to ask you. And but again, these are things that probably in reality you can only get from a second viewing or a third viewing, which of course not many people do. But yeah, it's really just having that. I suppose confidence that your audience isn't as stupid as. You know, your financier or your producers or whatever, and that the audience will put it together because the audience, you know, has grown up watching films, and even though not every single person is going to get it, and sometimes maybe even, you know, you maybe need to see it a couple of times, and certainly with Fashionista, probably more than any of my films, which, you know, is structurally all over the place in a very designed way. The few people that I've met, about five or six people who've seen it twice, or more, and everyone's been like, oh my god, you know, so, you know, we really liked the first time, the second time it's like we actually feel we understood it because it's putting those pieces together, and Red, White, and Blue is slightly different, but I think there's so much detail in it.
No, the repeat viewings of Red, White, and Blue, there is that your kind of choreography of setup and payoff, because when the first couple of times I watched this and even the second time, I never understood Nate as being anything but a deluded psychopath, in a sense. Even the phone call at the end, I remember when the film finished, I was like, certainly the first time I watched it, I was thinking, is he really having a conversation with someone about a job in this CIA? Is this just part of his dance in his head?
Yeah.